Hello, and welcome to Money Talks from Slate Money. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, and this week I am going to nerd out on my single favorite subject in the entire history of finance, which is not just sovereign debt restructuring, but Argentine sovereign debt restructuring. This is going to be a historic conversation. I'm sure about this. It's going to be absolutely amazing. Here at Slate Money, we receive a lot of books and we read a lot of books and we talk to a lot of authors. And in this case, I received a book from a chap named Greg Makoff, all about the court fight over the Argentine debt restructuring that began, I guess, in the mid-2000s. And it was a great book, and I blurbed it, and it's out, and you should go read it. It's called Default by Greg Makoff. And the person I am talking to about this book is not. Instead, I am talking to Jay Newman. Jay, welcome.
Felix, I'm extremely excited to be here.
If you've heard about this case at all, you've probably heard it referred to as Elliott versus Argentina. And Jay basically is Elliott for these purposes. Jay was working for Elliott. Jay represented Elliott. Jay was the person who came up with the whole strategy. So we're going to talk about this big fight between Jay Newman and the country of Argentina. And this is like Jay, who's one guy on the show, versus an entire sovereign nation. He, spoiler alert, winds up winning the fight to get paid back on the bonds that Argentina issued and then defaulted on. There's a bunch of judicial intrigue. This thing goes on for 16 years. We're going to talk about how it began, how it ended, and everything in between. It's all coming up on Money Talks by Slate Money. Jay, let's start with you introducing yourself, and take some time on this one because I feel like this is key to why this conversation is going to be so interesting.
Where to start? My name is Jay Newman. I've spent more or less 40 years in international finance, starting back at Lehman Brothers when I was started one of the first loan trading desks in the early 1980s. And over time, watching the loans trade and understanding what the contracts meant, I changed my view of sovereign debt. Because for a long time, people thought that sovereign debt were, you know, the story about trading sardines and eating sardines, Felix? Should I tell that one?
Yes, it's a famous story, but it's well worth talking, well worth saying, because people talk about trading sardines the whole time. And I feel like half the time that people talk about trading sardines, no one understands what they're talking about.
After World War I in Germany, when there was a massive inflation to the point where people were using wheelbarrows to cart around Deutschmarks, people resorted to trading. So they would trade shoes and sardines and, you know, whatever they had lying around. And one day, somebody traded a can of sardines for a pair of shoes. And that seemed like a fair trade at the time. But a couple of days later, the guy that received the sardines found the guy to whom he traded his shoes and said, "I want my shoes back because I opened the sardines and they were rancid." And the guy who had the shoes said, "Why did you open the can of sardines?" And the other guy said, thinking it was quite natural, "Because I was hungry." And the other guy said, No, you just don't understand. Those weren't eating sardines. Those were trading sardines." And for a long time, people viewed sovereign debt as trading sardines. But it became clear to me over time that the loan agreements and the loan contracts and some of the bond contracts were actually extremely strong and could be enforced. And the reason that was important is that as time went on, the restructuring deals that were being struck between countries and banks were worse and worse and worse for creditors, to the point where creditors had exhausted all their resources and all their leverage, and they're willing to take whatever was given to them.
I'm gonna just jump in right here and say that, like, intuitively, it is not hard to understand why that might be the case. Because on the one hand, you have some investor who's sitting in a room in New York holding a piece of paper. And on the other hand, you have a sovereign nation which makes its own laws and does what it's like and is beholden to no one.
Least of all its people.
And one of them says, like, you owe me money. And the other one says, well, what are you going to do about it? You can't do what creditors used to do back in the 19th century, which is send in the gunboats and start a war. So you basically take what you're given. Or that certainly used to be the case before you came along and decided that there was an alternative.
Well, I think that's a fair comment. I think the question is, what are you given? What do you have when you buy sovereign debt? You have a contract in one form or another, and you've got to make the best of it as a creditor.
And this was your great insight, was that, in fact, if you looked at the words that were written down on this piece of paper, and most importantly, this little line near the top of the piece of paper saying that the country waived its sovereign immunity for the purposes of this contract, whereas normally you can't take a country to court in this particular case when it's to do with repaying its debt, you can take the country to court. And you kind of said, well, actually, I do have more leverage than these aren't just trading sardines. I don't need to just buy them if I think they're going up and sell them if I think they're going down. I can go in there myself, take a country to court and change the outcome and get more money. And this was seismic. I mean, it's almost impossible to overstate how much this changed the world of countries borrowing and repaying money.
Fair comment, Felix. And I think there are a couple of elements there that need unpacking, not the least of which is the point you make about sovereign immunity and the legal framework under which sovereign debt is issued. But let me just give an example first, because I think it'll set the stage for it. Panamanian debt in the mid-1990s was being restructured, and Panama owed approximately $2 billion to its creditors and had negotiated a deal under which it was given complete debt forgiveness for 50% of what it owed. So it struck a deal with the Bank Advisory Committee that cut the size of its debt obligation from $2 billion to $1 billion. But here's the rub. Panama at that point in time was just 3 years away from the handover of the Panama Canal and all the related properties. The Panama Canal and all related properties were estimated at the time to be worth something like $10 billion. So the fundamental question that I had for the negotiating committee is, why would you negotiate a transaction in which you're writing off half the debt? Why aren't you simply restructuring the debt, extending the payout period, maybe reducing the coupon a bit, but saying that since you, as an heir to a great fortune, will be receiving $10 billion in 3 years, let's talk about a restructuring that takes account of that. And that's where the bank advisory negotiating process had completely fallen apart, because all they wanted to do was get rid of the problem. That's a case in point. There are others that are equally egregious. But the other point I want to make is, you're going back to your reference to the bond contract and sovereign immunity. The entire framework of sovereign lending under New York or UK law is founded on a statute called the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act in the US, or the State Immunities Act in the case of the UK, which enable countries to waive immunity and consent to be sued in those jurisdictions. But let me just say at the outset, that experiment in sovereign debt and sovereign lending and the framework for borrowing in a currency not your own has been a complete, utter, abject failure, a horror show.
And so I was going to get to this at the end, but since you brought it up at the beginning, we will just like get to the punchline, which is that you believe that sovereign immunity should just come back in full force and that no one should be able to sue sovereigns for repayment of debt. And basically, if a sovereign wants to try and issue a bond, it can try and issue a bond on the basis of I keep my promises, and that's about it. And just take the entire sort of jurisprudential, you know, edifice out of the equation altogether.
That is my point of view. I think that if we eliminated the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and the State Immunities Act, we would be back to a situation, as you say, where a country would have to borrow under its own law. And what people say when you suggest that is, but they won't be able to borrow. And my answer is, wouldn't that be better? Wouldn't it be better than having profligate borrowing under the illusion that there are contractual protections? I think we'd be much better off if there were less borrowing, and countries, in order to borrow more, would have to behave in a manner that justified them borrowing in their own currency and under their own laws.
And basically what you're saying here is that your entire career has been built on exploiting a sort of sovereign immunity loophole that oughtn't to exist.
That's kind of a leading question. I don't even know how to parse that, Felix.
But this is what you did. You discovered, was it with Panama or even earlier, that you could sue these countries and get more than they had agreed to pay, you know, the bank creditor committee or whatever. And then you went on and did this in bigger and bigger cases, culminating in Argentina, winning billions of dollars from Argentina, and all under the general umbrella of this law saying that you could and would and did sue these countries in federal court in New York.
Felix, that's quite true. It's without the FSIA and the SIA, you wouldn't have had the bond contracts written as they were, agreeing to the jurisdiction of the US and UK and agreeing to waive immunity against suit and enforcement. And you wouldn't have had those, and it wouldn't have been possible. It's quite true. But as I say, it's this experiment which started in with, I think the FSIA was first passed in 1976 or 77. From the get-go, we had a debt crisis starting in 1979, 1980, the so-called lost decade. It was, you know, a horrific period for borrowers and for creditors. But no one ever went back and looked at the underlying assumption and said, maybe the whole approach is misbegotten.
Well, you and I have both read Greg Makoff's book, which is a gripping courtroom drama, yes. I would say. And the book is focused on the biggest and most notorious of all of these cases that you just talked about, where Argentina defaulted on its debt in 2000. It tried various forms of restructuring over the years. Some of them, they had greater and lesser degrees of success. You and a few others were among the final holdouts who were still wanting more than the people who'd agreed to restructure their debt had agreed to accept. And finally, I guess in 2016, you got paid. It was like 16 years after the original default. This was a long and extremely acrimonious tale, and you were at the heart of it. So I have many questions for you about it, but let's just start with the big one, which is like, what did you think of the book? And is it the definitive account of this tale that it aspires to be?
I think that Greg did an absolutely amazing job of distilling a very long saga and a very complicated story into something that's quite readable. And I'm quite appreciative because reading the book was like visiting a lot of old friends. some fond memories, some painful memories, but nonetheless, a great story. And he teased out the story amazingly to me from public sources. He teased it out from press reports, from transcripts, from agreements. I don't think he had a lot of access to the people involved, because I think I'm not sure how many people actually spoke to him.
I think quite a lot. I think the hedge funds, you and your, what he calls Fran clan, notwithstanding, and we can talk about that a bit later. I think on the Argentine side, he spoke to quite a few people. Obviously, the one person he couldn't speak to because he died in 2017 was Thomas Grisey, who was the judge at the heart of this case, who oversaw the case. And the story, really, to me, is the story of how you understood Thomas Grisey. You understood what he would do if you asked him to do a certain thing at a certain time. And the story is your ability to wait to ask him for, you know, certain injunctions or whatever until he was so sort of steaming mad that he would grant them. That there was a lot of real sort of psychological insight on your part in terms of how to play this court case in the specific courtroom of the specific judge. Would you say that's right?
I mean, legal judges are people. And I think it's very important to approach litigation that way. It's not a science. There's a lot of discretion in the hands of the judge. And it was very important to create an environment in which Judge Grisey felt that our claims were credible and supported by the documentation. So there is definitely an element in any court battle where you've got to understand the judge and what the judge is going to find interesting, appealing, constructive in resolving the case. And I'll say that Judge Grisey, I mean, he worked very hard at this, but he gave Argentina, and I think we felt this at many points over the years, he gave Argentina every possible break he could give them. I would say he was quite fair, maybe more than fair, from my perspective. And part of why the case took so long to resolve is because he did give them so much rope over time. Until he didn't, because ultimately it became apparent, and he embraced this. It became apparent that Argentina had no intention of obeying any court orders. And this goes for the Court of Appeals as well. It was Greg quotes a session before the Court of Appeals where I think it was Judge Raji asks Argentina's lawyer whether if they rule a certain way, Argentina will abide by the ruling. And he says, no, they won't. Argentina was, and I think remains, uniquely recalcitrant as a borrower and as a debtor.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Slate Money is sponsored this week by BetterHelp. A lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but the question that raises is time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you spend that time? The best way to squeeze that special thing into your schedule is to know what's important to you and make that thing a priority. How do you find out what's important to you? Therapy. Therapy can help you find out what matters to you so that you can do more of that thing. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire, get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime, no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/slatemoney today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/slatemoney. The big thing that happened in this case was that Judge Grisey came up with this remedy. He basically said Argentina had a whole bunch of bonds that it was paying out on, that he, you know, restructured debt that it was paying. And Judge Grisey basically handed down this injunction to various sort of financial middlemen, which ensured that Argentina basically had a very stark choice. It could either default on all of its debt again, even though it didn't want to, or it could pay you off and continue to service that debt. And this injunction was the biggest news that I can ever remember in the world of sovereign debt. It was, you know, covered extensively by not only by myself, but by the entire financial press, and certainly like the popular press in Argentina. No one could talk about anything else. It was a massive injunction. It changed the course of sovereign debt. And it seems to me that that injunction, as you say, was not something that followed naturally from whatever was in the letter of the bond contract, but was rather a response to the fact that Argentina was being uniquely recalcitrant, or this other word that I love, which came up once or twice in the hearings, contumacious.
Mm. Well, that defines Argentina, or at least Argentina in that time frame. So what you're referring, obviously, to the application of the pari passu clause in the bond contract. So the pari passu clause is a pari passu clause is something that occurs in a lot of contracts. It basically has many different forms. The form of that clause has been changed dramatically since over the last 15, 20 years. I mean, post Argentina, the formulation which dealt with pari passu treatment, I'll go back and define what that is in terms of payment, not just ranking, has been obliterated. So that this remedy and this clause no longer exists. But the thing that puzzled me was the hand-wringing over the application of the clause, because I just want to read the words, because people make stuff up about this all the time. And I think it's important to focus on what the words say. I'm reading from page 178 of Greg's book here. It says that the payment obligations of the Republic under the securities shall at all times rank at least equally with all its other present and future unsecured and unsubordinated external indebtedness. So the key words there are payment obligations. And there are different formulations of pari passu clauses. Some just refer to rank of the contract without any preference. But referring specifically to payment obligations made it a very, very different provision. And that's the provision that was the basis for Judge Grisey's ruling, which I should say he only made after 14 years of litigation in his court with a debtor who clearly didn't want to, in our view, negotiate in good faith to resolve its obligations. So that's that. I think it's important to have that context, because Judge Grisey, in order to provide the remedy he did, the injunction on payment of other debt, if the debt that we and other investors held, and by the way, there were dozens and dozens of investors, including many Italian bondholders and individual Argentines. It wasn't just a bunch of hedge funds. There was a large group that was owed this money. But for Judge Grisey to make that decision and to issue that injunction required an exercise of discretion. And I would say, having watched Judge Grisey closely, he ruled this way because he felt there was no other way to get Argentina's attention and get them to focus on finally resolving the cases after so many years.
So this is interesting. Rewind a few years, and your own lawyers went up in front of Judge Grisey and said, like, we have absolutely no intention of pulling this pari passu stunt. You were famous for pari passu at the time because you'd used it in a previous case with Peru and won. This had kind of set the cat among the pigeons, and everyone was like, oh shit, we thought this was boilerplate. It turns out it might have some teeth after all. And so this was one of the first things that Argentina did. They were like, are you going to do this pari passu thing? And what you said was, no, we have no real intention to do that. And then you didn't. And then you didn't. And then you didn't. And then eventually, as you say, after many, many years of bad faith and contumaciousness, you did. And one of the most fascinating parts of this book is, why and how did you wait so long before you brought these pari passu cases? And how, more importantly, were you just one of many creditors? Were you able to twist the arms behind the scenes of all of the other creditors and say, like, look, we're not going to do this and you guys shouldn't do it either. Let's all wait.
What you're referring to is the very first time that pari passu was mentioned in Judge Grisey's courtroom. It wasn't mentioned by creditors. because for a very long time, for 12, 14 years, creditors believed that they could negotiate a resolution with Argentina without necessarily being disruptive of its other agreements with other creditors. What happened early on, I think the point at which it was raised was probably around 2005. It was raised by Argentina's lawyers, who, being aware of what had happened in the Peru case, wanted to jump the gun, and they wanted Judge Grisey to issue what we thought would be nothing more than an advisory opinion, because this is the debtor asking the judge to make a decision about rights of creditors that the creditors hadn't invoked. And it hadn't been invoked for a variety of reasons, not least of which was that creditors thought that they could negotiate with Argentina. And in fact, some did over the next decade. There were a number of transactions involving Argentine debt, which reduced the amount of the debt owing. But this was an attempt a failed attempt on the part of Argentina's lawyers to jump the gun and essentially eviscerate a contractual right that creditors hadn't yet sought to invoke. And it took another decade before creditors got so frustrated with the course of the litigation and the cost of litigation and Argentina's, as you said, contumacious behavior, that we finally said it's time. We now are going to ask Judge Grisey to invoke the pari passu clause and ask for an injunction against payment of other debt unless our debt in question was satisfied.
Who are you referring to there when you say we?
So there were a few hedge funds that were spearheading litigation and paying the bills for litigation, but that work benefited literally dozens of maybe hundreds of creditors that all participated and benefited from Judge Grisey's rulings.
And those firms that were spearheading the litigation, and you were the biggest and most well-known of them, to what degree were you coordinating between each other before making decisions like now is the time to bring a pari passu suit?
There was a fair amount of coordination and constructive debate about strategy amongst the creditor group broadly. It was a complicated to keep people on the same page, to keep people focused, to not, in many cases, abuse a judge's appetite for motions and different requests. There was a lot of coordination amongst the creditor group.
And it seems to me that that's one of the things that you in particular were very good at, was that sort of behind the scenes coordination. I mean, hedge funds by their nature tend to be pretty sort of bloody minded and independent. Your ability to keep the creditor group more or less on the same page for a decade is quite an achievement, no?
I don't want to take sole credit for that, Felix, because there's a group of very thoughtful people and very constructive people. They were all interested in working together in a coherent way.
There's a moment in 2014 where, according to Makoff, you were willing to settle at like a 35% discount around the time that you seized an Argentine naval ship. Was that seizing of the naval ship the thing that kind of scuttled those talks?
There were so many overtures over the years. I would say, in fact, we were continually trying to get the attention of the Argentines with different ideas about how to settle the case. And without commenting on, in particular, one offer or another, there were many attempts. The arrest of the Libertad ship was, like so many other overtures, an effort to get the attention of the decision makers. We could argue about whether that was good or bad, accelerated things or delayed things, but it certainly became a cause.
It made the case even more political in Argentina than it had been previously. Someone was saying, I can't remember who, that this most recent election of Javier Milei as the president of Argentina is pretty much the first Argentine presidential election in living memory where the debt hasn't been the number one issue and hasn't been like the main thing that was being argued about in the election. Like, this is a deeply felt and has been for many, many years, a deeply felt part of the Argentine psyche. And did you ever feel like you were up against not just, you know, Cleary Gottlieb and Argentine technocrats, but, you know, 40 million Argentines? None of them liked you very much.
I think that Argentina has a troubled history when it comes to actually running its economy well and fiscal probity. And that was the underlying context of the battle between creditors and Argentina over many years. And we became unfortunately, an all too convenient whipping boy for Cristina Kirchner in particular, claiming that Argentina had the moral high ground, referring to creditors as vultures, when the reality was that Argentina, by the way, to this day, has failed to enact policies that will really unleash the growth that's going to be possible if President Milei is successful. So I think that the underlying context was that Cristina Kirchner didn't want to do business as usual in Argentina and not actually accept the idea that she wasn't running the economy very well at all and needed to think about, you know, her approach rather than just attack people who wanted their contractual rights recognized.
Well, okay, so let's rewind here. You were working for a hedge fund at the time called Elliott Associates. You had a certain amount of money to go out and buy bonds with, which you did, and the idea was to get a return on that investment. And obviously, the more years it takes to get a return on that investment, the lower the annualized return, unless you can find some clever thing on France. So was your boss at Elliott, Paul Singer, was he basically pressuring you to get this tied up more quickly? Was there tension on that front?
I can't really speak to our deliberations and our strategic considerations at Elliott. But what I can say is I think the surmise, and I think Greg Makoff does a good job of teasing this out, there were so many twists and turns in this whole process that one really never knew where the case was headed, because it was at every step of the way, it looked like you might turn a corner and all of a sudden there would be an opening to resolve it. And I think resolve it for broadly speaking, because it couldn't just be resolved for a few hedge funds. It needed to be resolved for all the creditors that remained outstanding. You know, one thing led to another. It was continually surprising that there was no possibility of actually negotiating with the Kirchner, the Nestor, and then Cristina administrations. But I think they were really the obstacle over a long period of time, because they found, I think, unfortunately, that using foreign creditors as the whipping boys for a populist agenda was more attractive than actually getting on with the business of running a country in a productive way.
And in the end, you wound up getting paid when they were no longer in office, which is not dissimilar to how you wound up getting paid in the previous Peru case. You were fighting with one government, the government changes, and then the new government comes in and settles. Was the whole court case kind of just a sideshow to, like, waiting for the Kirchners to get kicked out?
Felix, I think in retrospect, that's what it turned out to be. It looked like it couldn't have settled while they were there. That may not be completely true, but it was too useful, I think, as a rhetorical tool to have creditors to blame the sorry state of Argentina's economy on. It was just too easy. Obviously, we didn't welcome that. We didn't necessarily expect that, but that turned out to be the political reality on the ground.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up. especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Are you selling a little? A lot? Shopify helps you sell basically anything. It is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from launching your online shop to opening up a real life store to, oh my God, I just hit 1 million orders. Shopify is there every step of the way. It will help you grow. Doesn't matter whether you're selling scented soap or outdoor outfits. They help you sell everywhere. Name the country you want to sell. They will help you sell in it. They are Canadian themselves. They understand this is a whole big world. It's not just America, people. Sell your stuff from an all-in-one e-commerce platform that even has an in-person point-of-sale system. Wherever, whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. They even now have this thing called Shopify Magic, which is an AI-powered all-star, which will help you sell even more with less effort. And they have award-winning help to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/money, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/money now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/money. You're, of course, very alive to political realities. You are famous for having pushed through various laws in Albany, in the Peru case, when it came to interest on interest. You had a pretty expensive and elaborate lobbying organization in Washington with the Argentina case. What did it feel like when you realized that on some level, like, this job you chose for yourself involved becoming a politician with all of the, you know, messiness that involves and with all of the personal animus that involves in the Argentine?
Sovereigns come to the world and come to courts with a huge amount of credibility, and judges give sovereigns an enormous amount of deference because they are sovereigns. We can debate, you know, the nature of sovereignty and legitimacy and whether politicians are legitimate or illegitimate and whether they do their jobs well or not. But just the practical reality is that judges hearing from a country say, I'm hearing from a country, and we have to respect the fact that it is a sovereign state, notwithstanding the fact that the sovereign has signed a contract and agreed to be bound by the rule of law. Notwithstanding that, notwithstanding all the waivers and the agreement not to claim immunity and the agreement to treat people equally under pari passu clauses, notwithstanding all of that, sovereigns get enormous benefit of the doubt, which makes it very, very difficult to oppose a sovereign, not just in court, but in, let's call it, the court of public opinion. And it's true that over a long period of time, I think creditors in general try to explain, you know, their position, our position, broadly to international institutions, to the press, to periodic political figures that decided that, you know, they had something to say about this, whether in Argentina or out, because of that inherent weight of sovereignty. So it's a fair point that over a long period of time, creditors have learned the importance of telling their story in a credible way and putting in context what they're doing because of that inherent deference.
I mean, I have to say, I don't think they've succeeded very well. In the general narrative when it comes to sovereign debt still talks a lot about vulture funds. It talks about countries having too much debt. It talks about jubilees. Do you feel like you've moved the needle in your, that people are more sympathetic to you at all as a result of all of your lobbying efforts?
The needle has definitely moved. The way the needle has moved is that sovereigns have, over the last 20-odd years, probably started in the year 2000, have changed the bond contracts dramatically. And one way they've changed it is by eliminating the formulation of pari passu clauses that I read earlier. That's gone. Maybe there are a couple of legacy bond contracts that have that language in it, but it's 99.9% don't. And the other thing that sovereigns have done is to change the rules relating to changing the bond contract, the so-called collective action provision, to make it much easier to cram down restructurings. Sovereigns have also changed the rules relating to whether you can sue directly and individually or whether you have to go through an indentured trustee. That's now the prevalent form of enforcement. So for better or for worse, the rights that creditors had under the Argentine bonds that were the subject of Greg's book and that litigation, those rights have been thoroughly eviscerated, which is why, you know, I wrote a piece for the FT some time back that refers to sovereign debt as unsafe at any price, kind of taking a page out of Ralph Nader's unsafe at any speed. But I really do think that creditors' rights have been a victim of a concerted campaign over a long period of time that's been waged by the lawyers for sovereign issuers and by sovereigns.
The one exception to that rule, of course, being the creditor known as China, which seems to have more power than ever.
China is a very special case, maybe a subject of a separate podcast.
We will have another podcast on the question of China. But let me finish off just by asking you about the Franz, because the Franz are one of the most fascinating parts of this whole story. Argentina had lots of bonds, it defaulted on lots of bonds, and there was this one pretty tiny bond issue. What was it, like $300 million, something like that, in terms of original issue amount, which had some pretty crazy terms in terms of how quickly the past due interest would compound. To the point at which, partly because this whole thing dragged on much longer than anyone ever imagined it might, resulted in the final payout not being 100 cents on the dollar, but rather being 1,000 cents on the dollar. And you were one of the biggest holders of the Franz, along with Nancy Zimmerman at Bracebridge, and was it Aurelius? I can't remember. Montreux. And the return that the Fran clan got on their investments, which were, you know, mostly bought, according to Greg, below par, like penny, you know, some kind of fraction of a dollar, and got paid out many multiples of par. That seems to be the one thing that sticks in people's craws a little bit more, you know, more than anything else in this deal, the sheer massive return on those bonds, just from a kind of fundamental equity perspective. Do you understand that objection to that particular bit of the deal?
So Argentina issued debt under different terms, mostly fixed rate coupons, but there were a couple of issues that were floating rate. And in some of those issues, there were caps on the rate of interest And in a couple of issues, there were no caps, so that when the reference bond price changed, the interest rate would float. And when Argentina defaulted, the rate floated to a high level.
So like 100%.
As published in the Wall Street Journal in accordance with the bond contract. But this goes to, you know, the fundamental question of investing in sovereign debt. You really have to read your documentation very carefully. And the reason that Argentina issued that bond in the first place without a cap was because they were desperate to borrow money. And they felt that that was all they could do if they wanted to borrow money at that point in time. So I just say that it's always important to read your contracts. And Argentina knew throughout the whole process of negotiation and litigation, Argentina knew those bonds were there. They knew the terms of the bonds. In conversations that creditors had with them, it was no secret. And this goes to, again, to the point of why Argentina took so long to come to the table. It wasn't a good look. It didn't serve Argentina well. And it would have been much better for, I think, everybody if it had been resolved very, very early on and didn't extend for, as you said, for 16 years. Look, Felix, I think that we're in what appears to be another cycle of sovereign defaults. We've had a few. We're going to have more. Maybe we're going to have a dozen more, 20. It's hard to say how many, but I think the process is really broken. I think it's the whole system is built to fail. And I think that's a separate conversation about whether we have the right structure for sovereign lending, sovereign borrowing, and sovereign bond contracts. And I'd love to have that conversation with you. I think it's we can dig in pretty deeply on.
So your proposed solution, as you said, is just abolish the FSAA.
For a start.
For a start. And then for the legacy debt that everyone is defaulting on, this common framework that we're trying to make work right now, that one's DOA, that one's just not going to work at all?
It'll work the way it's worked for these kind of chaotic restructurings, badly, inefficiently. And I think that the addition of, as you point out, of the Chinese to the mix only makes things more complicated and treacherous, particularly for debtors. So I think there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot to be done. But I think unless something dramatic is done, we'll keep having these cycles. And cycles are, they're dangerous, they're fraught, they're bad for the debtor countries, but they're probably good for China. I think they're certainly good for some local politicians that are the ones that borrow the money in the first place. But overall, it's quite dangerous and pernicious.
On which note, Jay Newman, thank you very, very much for coming on the show. And do plug your novel, since you're now a novelist.
Oh, so thank you, Felix. Thank you. And thanks for having me. So my first book is called Under Money, which is a financial political thriller. It's set in the world of high finance and the world of hedge funds. I think it's got a lot of fun bits about how the world works, and I hope people find it entertaining.
And is there a second one coming out?
Second one coming out, almost done, another four or five chapters called Uncertainty, which is a sequel to Under Money. All the characters that don't die in the first book survive for the second.
Fantastic. Jay Newman, thank you very much.
Felix, thank you.
Thank you very much to Jared Downing and to Shana Roth for producing. And let us know what you thought on SlateMoney@slate.com.